关系最新发展，锁定海峡论坛。欢迎收看美国之音的海峡论坛，我是樊东宁。在今天的节目当中，我们要为您介绍两本新书。第一本是2021年11月32岁的美国亚裔科学家曾玉佳与英国科学作家马特·雷德利 Matt Ridley 合著的《病毒新冠肺炎溯源》The Search for the Origin of COVID-19 在美国上市。该书被誉为是梳理病毒溯源各种理论最全面的著作之一。新冠大流行初期，曾玉佳就发表论文质疑新冠肺炎自然溢出理论，曾经被戴上阴谋论者的帽子。曾玉佳现在是互联网上调查新冠病毒溯源最有影响力的专家之一。那么他在接受美国之音驻纽约记者方斌专访的时候表示，他确信有人掌握病毒来源的证据，最终会有人告诉我们答案。下面请看专访的完整内容。
First of all, can you tell me what's new in your book in terms of new facts, new analysis, and new findings that readers can learn about the search of origins of COVID-19?
Almost 2 years of investigation. So our book, it really reads like a nonfiction science thriller or a mystery book.You follow us through our journey, finding the origin of COVID-19, and we bring you through like the wildlife trade in China. We bring you through like the bat caves, miners, the dangerous pathogen research, the virus research that's happening in China and other places around the world. We tell you about lab escapes in the past. And at the end of the book, we tell you all the latest findings relating to the origin of this virus. AndIt doesn't end there. So when a reader gets to the end of the book, you really realize this is just the beginning. There's so much more we need to do to find the origin of this virus.
It seems that your book studied every existing possibilities that could lead to find the origin of COVID-19, cause the pandemic. How important do you think is the search?
The search is extremely important, and there are three reasons for that. So the first reason is that in order to prevent the next pandemic, we need to know how pandemics are being started. And so this is the worst pandemic in one century, and hopefully no more will happen in the next few years, but it is always possible. It's not that every pandemic waits 100 years before happening. It could happen in the next 2 years, in the next 10 years, or maybe the next 20 years. So to stop the next pandemic, we need to know, did this come from...the wildlife trade, was it pangolins or was it civet cats? Should we be doing things to stop those animals from being sold? Or did it come from a lab because of well-intentioned research? So research just trying to find a cure for diseases, accidentally creating a pandemic pathogen. So that's the first reason. The second reason is that we need to set a precedent, so a type of protocol, so that the next time a pandemic happens, hopefully not so soon, but if it happens again, we need to knowhow should we track the origin of that pandemic as quickly as possible so that we can stop that one from being as bad as this pandemic? And the last reason is really a human reason. So almost everyone alive right now has been impacted by this pandemic. A lot of us have lost a loved one. Lots of us have been shut down at home. You know, your kids are stuck with you in the house for the whole year and a half. So we really need an answer. It's not something we can say, the origin doesn't matter anymore, let's pretend this never happened. So we really need to have a real investigation.
In all these possibilities that you studied in your book, which one you feel it's the most plausible?
So I have to say that when Matt Ridley and I were writing this book, we thought both were quite possible. So we wrote this book.Almost from beginning to end, just wanting to put all the facts for the reader, both relating to the wildlife trade and also pathogen research. But just as our book was about to be sent off to the press for printing, there were all these documents being leaked or published online through the Freedom of Information Act. And they were showing that, unfortunately, in Wuhan and in other places collaborating with Wuhan, scientists were doing some fairly risky research. They were genetically modifying SARS-like viruses they had found in nature to... And these modifications sometimes made them more infectious, more dangerous to the infected animal. So we now really need to push for more transparency. So there are people, not just in China, but a lot of people outside of China, even here in the US of A, have information about that type of research. So we really want them to share that information with us so we can build a better, a clearer picture of what might have happened leading up to the emergence of COVID-19.
In your journey of searching the origins, what are the main obstacles made you and made us today, after almost 2 years of pandemic, still have to debate hypotheses that caused the pandemic, but still cannot really identify one?
Yes, so unfortunately, this problem of the origin of virus became very political very quickly. So in early 2020, people started calling it a conspiracy theory. It is only quite recently, only May of this year, and more recently, that people have started to say actually a lab origin is possible and plausible, and we need to be investigating it. So if you read our book, it tells you all of these stories of great human determination and ingenuity to find the truth. So even though they were being blocked in every way possible, so they couldn't ask the question publicly, you know, Facebook would censor you, Reddit would shut you down. Even though amongst the scientific community, you were called a conspiracy theorist for even asking if this virus could have come from a lab, people, individuals really pushed through. Like, there are citizen journalists, there are independent analysts who really kept digging until today they can finally say, we need to investigate.
Talk about China. The Chinese government now is to try to cover everything, mm-hmm. Probably related to the origin search, and try to suppress the Chinese whistleblowers vigorously.
Yes, that is also very troubling. And in our book, we have a whole chapter really highlighting the work and the courage of Wuhan whistleblowers. So you had doctors in Wuhan, you had journalists in Wuhan, even like citizen journalists. So people who are not journalists by profession, they were trying to tell people about what was happening in Wuhan. And so these people showed great bravery and courage. And it's really terrible that some of them were sent to prison, some of them were made to sign confessions, like some of them were tortured for just trying to share the truth about what was happening in Wuhan. And so one really important takeaway from this pandemic, and we bring this up in the book too, is really a need to set a precedent and to start having a pandemic treaty so that in the future, when this happens again, each country should be able to immediately nominate a representative and send those investigators into the city where the virus started and start finding information in real time. So we didn't find out that the virus was human-to-human transmissible until mid-January, about a month after the virus had been detected. We didn't get the genome, except a scientist had to pull it out of a Chinese collaborator. So these things cannot happen again. We cannot accept this as the status quo.
Your book also accounts many incidents of a lab leak in history. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the relevance of these incidents to today's search for COVID-19 origin?
Yes. So we describe many stories of lab escapes, so different viruses escaping from labs, not just in China, but many other countries. So smallpox, for example, in the UK, China and Singapore and Taiwan, there were lab escapes of the first SARS virus. So it doesn't matter which country, as long as you're doing that type of dangerous research there is always a chance. It just depends. One day the lab technician is having a bad day and spills something, then there's a possible exposure. So we write about these stories to help people understand that even if you have the highest biosecurity level, there's always human error. Everybody makes mistakes. There's nobody who is so skilled and so powerful that they never make a single accident in their whole life.
Yeah, Elena, the book says your life has been forever changed after plunging into the question of the origin of SARS-CoV-2. What happened? What is the most forgettable, unforgettable, and impressive thing that changes your life forever, you can tell us?
Yeah, so I have to say that the moment that made me most excited and maybe nervous was when I and 17 other top scientists around the world signed a letter that was published in Science magazine in May 2021. and we called for an investigation of both natural and lab origins. So we said both are plausible, and we need to focus on getting more information. So we shouldn't be guessing where the virus came from. We need to be scientists, and we need to show the same determination and courage as the people in Wuhan, the first doctors and journalists who gave even their lives to tell us the truth about this virus. So we said we need to investigate. And within weeks, the U.S. White House, the Biden administration, announced they told their intelligence community to put together all of the information they have and to put out a report. And so we felt, as scientists, very validated that we were heard by the government. And they opened an investigation in the intelligence community. And so just thinking of this journey over the past almost 2 years now, where the lab origin hypothesis kept being described as a conspiracy theory. For more than a year, people were calling me all sorts of names. Even other scientists were calling me names and telling me to, hoping that bad things would happen to me and that kind of thing. Like even other scientists, it was really, really tough. But finally, recently, in the last half a year, I'd say there has been a complete turnaround. So now I have so many top scientists privately emailing me saying, don't stop searching, keep going, you're onto something. And I feel really validated by that.
I'm following you in Twitter and see your reaction to WHO's new group for study the origins of coronavirus. Can you talk about a little bit about that? What is your reaction to the new group?
So the World Health Organization realized how badly they had performed in that joint study with China. And so they wanted to form a new group to advise the next phase of study. They were given an opportunity to establish a completely new set of experts, free of conflicts of interest. Because one of the worst parts of the WHO joint study with China was that they picked a person with almost the greatest conflicts of interest possible. They picked Peter Daszak, who is the president of the EcoHealth Alliance, who was part of the virus research ongoing in Wuhan. So imagine for him to investigate himself and say, maybe I caused the pandemic. that was crazy. That was, frankly, like just one of the most shocking things to see in a international study convened by the WHO. So for them, this new group called SAGO was a chance to start on a clean slate. But disappointingly, they decided not to do that. So when they announced names, again, we saw so many of the people in there, they either had called the lab origin a conspiracy theory, they had called it debunked, a classic conspiracy theory, they called the people who wanted an investigation like conspiracy theories, like, you know, that kind of thing. And there were also people, again, with financial conflicts of interest. So people doing the same type of research who collaborate with the EcoHealth Alliance. So again, it's like asking them to investigate their friend. It's like asking them to investigate someone who pays them money. So they're receiving money from them even still today. And you're asking them to investigate the EcoHealth Alliance and say, did SARS-CoV-2 result from EcoHealth Alliance funded work? So I think that the WHO really, really missed this opportunity to have a proper investigation.
So what is your expectation of a search for SARS-CoV-2 2022 next year? Mm-hmm. It looks like you are not optimistic.
I am optimistic that one day we will find the answer, because we live in this world where almost everything is recorded. Like you have phones, like you have, you know, internet, you have emails, like everything is archived digitally somewhere. So it is impossible to completely wipe out all traces of knowledge of where this virus came from. In fact, I believe that there are at least a handful of people who have such evidence of where this virus came from. Like life cannot go back to normal, especially for China, without knowing where a killer virus emerged inside of China. You can't just be out there partying and living your life without knowing when another killer virus will emerge. So I am actually pretty confident that there are people who know where this virus came from. So maybe today they don't feel safe to tell us. Maybe it's another 5 years or 10 years or maybe it's 50 years. But someone will eventually tell us. This is like one of the most major events in this century. Like there's no way it is going to be forgotten and it's just a mystery forever. So for me, what is really important next year is that the international leadership and the scientific leadership really steps up and shows that we can investigate, we can do our best efforts and start parallel routes of investigation. So don't depend on the World Health Organization. We need to set up our own real investigation, join forces internationally, and get to the root of where this virus came from.
Thank you so very much, Elena.
Okay, nice to talk to you.
好的，我们非常感谢美国之音记者方斌为我们所做的专访。接下来我们再为大家介绍另外一本新书，2021年10月两位德国前驻华记者加杰斯和奥斯特联手撰写推出德文版《习近平：全世界最有权势的人》一书。这本书是第一本关于中国国家主席习近平的传记作品。该书于2021年10月推出时，原计划在德国汉诺威孔子学院和杜伊斯堡孔子学院举行新书朗诵会，但遭到来自中国政府的压力而取消。朗诵会后来改到其他的地方举行，但却吸引了更多的观众参加。美国之音记者江真采访了两位作者的其中之一，前德国明星杂志的驻华记者加杰斯 Adrian Gorges。 下面请看专访的完整内容。
This had been the big surprise for us.When we started to talk about the idea of the book, we in this case is Stefan Aust, the longtime editor-in-chief of Der Spiegel and now publisher of Die Welt here in Germany, together with me as you know, long-term former China correspondent of Stern magazine. So we had this idea. And of course, the first thing is you look what exists already.And we found out nothing. I mean, there are some books in English of Carrie Brown, a British sinologist, which are nice books, but they are not biographies. So, and when we found out it doesn't exist yet, it was for us the sign, oh, it's even much, much more important that we write this book, because, I mean, Xi Jinping is...So important because on the one hand, China is so important for the world now. And on the other hand, Xi Jinping as a person has so much power, much more power than any of his, of the Chinese leaders before him. I mean, you can compare it to Mao Zedong, but this was in a time when China was a poor country, but now China is an economic superpower and he is the president and the leader of the party in a country which is controlled by one party, by the Communist Party.So he's so important, and the people in the West, they know nothing about him. Though this made it very important for us to do this. Okay, so the first question, we worked on it around 1 year, but it's of course...based on our work about all our life. So because of course, a lot of the reporting I did in China in the past also went into this book. So in fact, it's based on many years, even decades of work. How did we work together? We did not divide. You write one chapter, you write the other. It's all done together, which makes the book very strong, I think.Because Stefan is, of course, also somebody who often had been in China, who, as I said, interviewed Jiang Zemin, who was in Hong Kong for the handover, who went to Tibet and interviewed the party leader there. So who always was interested in China and traveled a lot to China, but mainly, of course, sees...China from the outside, as a famous German journalist sees it from the outside. While I am more the expert on China, I lived there for 10 years, I speak the language. I also some years had been there, not only as some years as a foreign correspondent, but also some years as a CEO of a German company. So I also know China from the business side.So I'm more the insider, so to say, and that we put these two perspectives together, I think this makes the book strong. He's smart in some way, otherwise he wouldn't have achieved what he's achieved now. I mean, your interview is exactly in the right week. I mean, this week, the historic resolution of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of China, which makes the Xi Jinping to the core, as they say, of the party and of the country and so on. I mean, to achieve this, I mean, you must be smart. And he, maybe some other people thought he would be stupid and thought it's fine to put him into this position. Maybe some other party leaders had this idea, but I mean, they had been wrong, because I mean, he immediately started with this anti-corruption campaign, which was not only against corruption, it was too against corruption, I think, but it was also like to take away all the people who had been competitors to him, or even the people who might have been competitors to him, who even didn't have anything against him, but he thought they might have be dangerous to him one day. And he succeeded in creating a climate in China, which we compare in the book to the climate under Stalin in the Soviet Union, that everybody is in fear, so that even people who might not like him are afraid to speak out against him, or even to speak out anything he might not like, simply because they are afraid. His motivation certainly is to make China stronger. And we analyze in the book also what brought him to this idea, not that we agree with him, but that we try to understand what is his motivation. And his motivation is very much, he looked at the downfall of the Soviet Union. He looks at the war in Yugoslavia, which also was a former socialist country. He looked at the Arab Spring. So he is a strong believer that if there would be some freedom in China, China, or at least the Communist Party of China, would fall down. So that is his strong belief. But I absolutely agree to what you hinted in your question. It might very much be by his attempt to make China stronger, he makes China weaker, at least in the long perspective. Because, I mean, for example, I mean, China is strong now because of its economic power. But we all know the facts of the history. This economic power is not thanks to the Communist Party. It's not thanks to Mao Zedong or something. This is only thanks to the reform and opening up under Deng Xiaoping, starting 1978. And it's more thanks to the hard work of the Chinese people after the Communist Party gave them some freedom, pulled a little bit away from controlling everything in the economy, in the culture, everything, so that the people started to work on their own and started to make their business, starting small businesses like restaurants or something, and then until like Jack Ma and other people created like big tech companies and so on. So this had been the base of the success of China in the last decades. And in his craziness to control everything, Xi Jinping is destroying exactly that. I mean, he is not completely nationalizing the companies, but he tries to have them so much under control so that this will, I'm quite sure, create big economic problems for China. I think that's very dangerous, and I think even his possible weakness, we were talking right now about that he might weaken China. He wants to strengthen China, but in reality, he might weaken China. But this makes it even more dangerous, because especially governments, such kind of leaders, when they are afraid to lose their power, they might look for some success in their idea to show, I'm the strong man internationally. And this is especially the case now for Taiwan, because Xi Jinping somehow made it clear that he wants the so-called reunification with Taiwan during his lifetime, during his term in office. And this is a big difference to the time before. I mean, the time before, we as Germans, we compared always like in the 1960s, in the 1970s, like when there was some celebration, some state holiday, it was always people talked about, leaders talked, politicians talked about the German reunification. But this only had been words. There was no real chance that time for unification. So, and in the time before Xi Jinping, also this had been mainly words. Nobody expected that Jiang Zemin or somebody would invade Taiwan. It was an idea for the long-term future to be one country with Taiwan. But Xi Jinping put himself under the time pressure to do this in his time in office, or means in the next years. And the other thing which makes it very dangerous, I mean, still Xi Jinping and other leaders, they are talking, okay, the best would be a peaceful unification with one country, two systems. But after Xi Jinping, with his craziness to control everything, destroyed the one country, two system in Hong Kong, like taking all the freedoms which Hong Kong had in the last decades. It had no democracy. To be honest, it also had no democracy under British rule, but it had freedom. I mean, still a few years ago, you could go in Hong Kong to a bookshop and buy all kinds of books about Mao Zedong and Xi Jinping and everything. This is impossible now. So now nobody in Taiwan believes in a peaceful unification. Nobody in Taiwan believes in one country, two system. So the only way for him to get Taiwan is by military force. I would love to go back to China one day, because, I mean, for me, this is, I love the country, the people, the culture, and so on. And I also see no reason why it should not be possible. I mean, when I was a Stern correspondent in Beijing, I also wrote articles which had been critical about this or that, but it was never a problem. We always had the good relations to the people in the foreign ministry. Of course, now under these new circumstances, it is hard to say what would happen. I mean, in the moment, it even makes no sense to ask the question because of the restrictions, because of COVID. It's anyway impossible to go to China. Even if I would have not written a book about Xi Jinping, it would be impossible in the moment. What will be possible in some years, who knows?
好的，我们非常感谢江真的采访报道。 专家发表的是个人观点，不代表美国之音。我是樊东宁，祝各位平安，我们下次节目再会。